This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Pretty Girls Dancing by Kylie Brandt, performed by Luke Daniels, Emily Sutton Smith, Lauren Ezzo, M. Eldridge, and Dan John Miller.
Whitney DeVries, October 30th, 11:48 p.m. Whitney reached under her pillow for her buzzing cell phone, read the text on the screen, and smiled.
Are you coming?
A wash of excitement flooded her as she stared at the words. Was she? She'd changed her mind a dozen times since she and Patrick had come up with this plan. Had half expected that in the end, he would change his mind, too. Ride a moped 12 miles, just so they could meet up for the first time in person? It had sounded thrilling when they'd started talking about it a couple of weeks ago. But now second thoughts dampened her excitement. Her dad would seriously kill her if she got caught. The text alert sounded again. This time there was a cartoon pic of a sad-looking donkey sitting in a snowbank.
Freezing my ass off here.
Delighted, she muffled a laugh in her pillow. Patrick's sense of humor was the thing she liked most about him. But it didn't hurt that he was hotter than any of the boys at her school. He was a sophomore, a year older than her, had blonde hair and Liam Hemsworth blue eyes, with a majorly cute dimple when he smiled. She'd seen him only twice before when she'd visited Graham in Blackston. They'd gone to the grocery store, and he'd been stocking shelves. As they'd walked by, Graham had noticed her looking and whispered, "What a hottie!" They'd laughed about that all the way home. And then a few months later, out of the blue, he'd friended her on Facebook. Her bestie, Macy, had agreed that it was clearly a sign. 2 weeks later, he'd messaged,
"Have I seen you in Blackston? Maybe at Mulder's last summer with your grandma?"
Mulder's had the best iced chocolate mochas, and Graham could take Whitney there only when her disapproving mom wasn't around. Whitney had never seen him there, so the thought of Patrick Allen checking her out the way she had him at the grocery store was totally cool. Soon they were exchanging messages or texts every day. He told her about his football injury the year before, and how depressed he'd been, just sitting on the sidelines. She'd confided about the huge fight with her mom and dad over her quitting dance to spend more time on soccer, and then being stuck as third-string goalie. They'd bitched about their strict parents and pesky brothers. Patrick had too. She could talk to him, really talk to him, even though there had been no actual phone calls because Patrick had zero privacy at his house. But tonight would be different. She could speak to him for the first time, face to face, the way she hadn't had the guts to last summer. A surge of courage rose, and she texted back, "Be there in a few." Before she could change her mind, again, Whitney slipped out of bed, setting the phone on the nightstand, and arranged the pillows on the center of her bed, covering them with the blankets. Dad had already checked in on her when he'd gotten home after second shift, which meant he'd be asleep by now. Quickly, she changed into the clothes she'd set out, just in case Patrick showed up, and in case she didn't chicken out of meeting him. She went to the dresser and dragged a brush through her hair. She froze when she heard a small sound. Waiting, her breath tangled in her chest. When she heard nothing further, the breath hissed out of her silently. Her mom had been in bed for hours, and once Dad turned in, the only one who might wake up was Ryan. At 10, he still had the occasional nightmare, which was funny, since he was the nightmare most of the time. She put on the fuchsia peacoat she'd draped over her desk chair, grabbed her cell, and tucked it into a pocket before moving toward the window facing the side yard. Because this wasn't the first time she'd sneaked out, she knew exactly how to slide each of the clips on the screen to unlock them. She rolled the crank to open the window, then eased the screen down and leaned it against the wall. Sending one last glance toward her closed bedroom door, she threw a leg over the casement, followed it with the other. A moment later, she was jumping nimbly to the ground and heading toward the backyard. It had been too risky to consider taking her bike. Her parents' bedroom was the closest to the garage, and her dad had superhuman hearing. A chilly wind sent dry leaves swirling around her, and the sound they made crunching beneath her feet seemed abnormally loud in the surrounding silence. She shivered, buttoning her coat as she walked. The park where she was meeting Patrick was just a few blocks away. She'd spent an hour with him, max, before returning home and climbing back into her room. No one would be the wiser. She had a sudden image of her dad in the window when she returned, and her step faltered. He was okay most of the time, but he could be completely unreasonable about some things. Curfew was one of them. An alert sounded again, and she dug in her pocket for her cell.
"If I get caught, I'll be grounded for life."
Then a picture of a prisoner behind bars. She smiled, her thumbs dancing over the keys in response. "You? I'm the one with a cop for a dad. Solitary for me." The Baxter's dog sent out a trio of barks as she hurried by the chain-link fence of her neighbor's yard. She kept a close eye on the windows of the house, but no lights snapped on, which had her breathing easier. Just another couple of blocks now. There wasn't any traffic on the street when she crossed it. No surprise there. Nothing happened in Saxon Falls after dark. Not that she ever got much of a chance to find out. Her mom and dad believed in Neanderthal parenting, because her curfew was still 10 o'clock. She once asked if they'd found their rules in a cave somewhere, chiseled on stone tablets, but neither had thought that was funny. When her phone sounded, she looked at the text, expecting to see another from Patrick. Instead, it was from Macy. "Is it on?" "It's on."
"Hot damn, girl!"
The accompanying emoji had a tongue hanging out, and Whitney's cheeks burned despite the brisk air. She hadn't considered much beyond actually meeting Patrick in the flesh. Just planning it had consumed their conversations over the last few weeks. His dad had been in the military and ran the family the way he had his platoon. From the sounds of it, he was stricter than Whitney's dad, whom she and Macy often referred to as Attila. She could see the park's entrance from here, and she increased her pace. Would he be shy or try to kiss her? Other guys had, and a few of them she'd kissed back. Nothing more than that, although Macy laughed and called her a prude. Michael Feldman had tried to stick his hand under her shirt, and she'd given him a fat lip. Of course, Michael looked like an orangutan with glasses. Whitney wasn't sure what she'd do if Patrick tried the same. Her cell pinged, and she slowed to look at the screen.
"I can't wait to see you."
Something warmed in the pit of her belly, and she texted back. "I'm here." She strained her eyes to find him. Clouds streaked the sky overhead, obscuring the stars, but an occasional sliver of moon shone through before it was lost again. The World War II monument was in back of the fountain. That was the spot they decided on, but it was still too far for her to make him out. Saxon Falls Park had never seemed spooky before, but she'd never been here at night, alone. The city had gone cheap on the lighting, and there were only a few street lamps dotting the area, all of which must turn off at midnight. She got a sudden chill and hunched farther into her coat, taking out her cell to switch on its flashlight app. There, she could see Patrick now, or rather his moped parked next to the monument. Her stomach did flips. She'd walked just a few blocks in the biting wind, but he'd driven 12 miles in it, just for her. The knowledge put a spring in her step, and Whitney thought maybe, just maybe, if Patrick wanted to feel her up, she'd let him. "Hey, you," she called out softly as she closed the distance to the monument. "Froze solid yet?" A shadow shifted behind the statue, but her gaze traveled beyond it to a hulking shape along the tree line fringing the park. The monument was near the rear of the area, and there was nothing else of size there. At least, there shouldn't be. Comprehension filtered in a moment later. It was a vehicle. A van. She stumbled to a halt, a hot ball of panic forming in her belly. The figure that stepped out from the corner of the statue was dressed all in black. Face, hands, clothes. Whitney didn't waste time screaming. She whirled, bolted. He might know the park, but he wouldn't be familiar with the woods surrounding it. It was there she headed, fear giving her feet wings. If she could make it, she had a chance. She could lose him among the trees, find the path he wouldn't. A mighty weight tackled her to the ground. She rolled, kicking and punching wildly. Two dark-clad arms grabbed her shoulders, pinning them to the ground. She latched her teeth into one arm, heard a vicious oath. Then a sharp needle of pain shot through her arm. She opened her mouth to shout. A gloved hand clapped over her lips. Whitney continued to struggle, but her limbs grew leaden. The black-hooded creature loomed above her. Panic still pounded through her veins, but her thoughts were scattered. She saw herself as if from afar, an insect struggling on a collector's pin. Her vision blurred as waves of unconsciousness threatened. The weight was removed. Freedom! The thought was a bolt of adrenaline. But when she commenced her legs to move, they remained unresponsive. She tried to raise a hand, only could twitch her fingers. She felt herself being lifted, carried by that hated person in black. It was getting harder to think, but one nebulous thought formed, swam across her mind. Leaving her room tonight had been the biggest mistake of her life.
Janie Willard, November 1st, 11:30 a.m.
Janie, out front, please. We're about to get busy.
There was a quick hitch in Janie's throat, a spreading heaviness in her chest, as she reluctantly turned away from the fryers and grills. Making her way from the kitchen to the Dairy Whip's front counter, she concentrated on the slow and steady breathing that could usually keep the deep-seated anxiety at bay. The medication in her purse would make speaking to people a bit easier, but for the last few months she'd been trying to curtail her dosage. She didn't want to end up like her mother, reliant on chemicals just to get through the day. A gaggle of high schoolers was crowding toward the front door, and she took her place next to a register, order pad ready. A quick scan of the faces revealed that she knew them all, at least by sight. They were only acquaintances because Janie didn't make friends. Except for Olivia Naughton, who'd steamrollered into her life in kindergarten and hadn't seemed to care that it had been nearly 9 months before Janie had spoken a word to her. Apparently, "Give me back that damn truck" had cemented whatever attraction Janie held for Olivia, because they'd been best friends ever since. The crowd at the counter separated into two lines, and Janie picked up a pen before saying automatically, "May I help you?"
Yeah.
The girl stared up at the posted menu as if entranced, seemingly oblivious to the people waiting behind her.
"I think a chocolate-dipped cone, medium. No, wait. What's the name of the one with sprinkles? I want that one."
It was simpler when Janie kept her head down, writing the orders, turning her back to make the treats. More difficult when she had to announce the amount, take the money, and count back change to interact. The place seemed to swell with bodies, with noise. So many words were floating in the air demanding responses, although fortunately not from her. She'd perfected the art of flipping a switch, robot mode, her therapist called it, and focused on the tedium while attempting to disregard the snippets of conversation floating around her. "See her costume last night? Sort of skanky, don't you? Gone for 2 days already. Cade seemed to like it. Probably ran off with a guy. I heard her dad was super strict.
He's a total player. What guy wouldn't?"
That's 3:28. The words came in a rush, but were steady enough. She collected the money and counted back the change. The girl, Ellie Breitbach, sat behind her in third period calculus. They'd never exchanged a word. Cone in one hand, change in the other, she turned away and picked up the conversation where she'd left off with her friend.
"Still, she's just so obvious. She's gonna get a rep if she doesn't..."
"May I help you?" Janie focused on the next customer, and then the next. The two lines dwindled. So thoroughly had she blocked the chatter that when the piercing words rang out, they took a moment to sink in.
"What do you think about it, Janie?"
She stilled, squelched the panic that threatened to surge, and searched for the speaker. Recognizing her, Janie's stomach clenched.
"About what?"
In a carefully studied move, Heather Miller gathered up her long, blonde hair in one hand before letting it cascade again, probably for the benefit of the slack-jawed boy glued to her side in the booth. "That girl that disappeared in Saxon Falls a couple of days ago. Surely you've heard, it's been on the news. She might even have been a victim of the 10-mile killer, like your sister. Don't you just think that's awful?" Responses raced across her mind and remained unuttered. She thought a lot of things, actually. Like how Heather was a bitch and the only person Janie knew whom she actively disliked. That she realized when she was being baited and would never give the girl the satisfaction of a reaction. Because even the mention of the 10-mile killer made Janie want to scream in ineffectual rage. But, of course, she said none of these. "I think they're wrong," she responded flatly. Doris, the manager, hurried over from the other register, protective as always.
"That's enough nonsense," she said loudly.
Pitching her voice lower, she murmured, "I've got the rest of this. You can go on back." Janie turned blindly, Heather's voice following her as she headed toward the kitchen.
"What? She's bound to hear about it. It's on the local channel.
Some people are saying it's just like Janie's." She walked straight through the kitchen to the hook by the back door where she'd left her things. She grabbed her purse before heading out the door, already digging into it for something to calm the nerves that were suddenly raw and quivering. With not quite steady hands, she found the package of cigarettes and shook one out. It took 3 attempts to light it. She drew deeply on the cigarette and let the smoke fill her lungs. But it did nothing to calm the riot in her blood. A girl was missing, and this time from nearby. It would start again. The instant hysteria, the inevitable comparisons. Janie's family history would be rehashed over coffee cups and diner tables. Because her sister's kidnapping 7 years ago had been the most sensational thing that had happened in West Bend, Ohio, since its last lynching, more than a century ago. She'd been 10 when Kelsey had disappeared. Vanished into thin air, the news stories had been titled with clickbait cliches, without a trace. There had been a media firestorm. It had seemed as though each time the TV had been switched on, there was a story about the Kelsey Willard kidnapping. Janie leaned her head against the siding of the building and blew out a thin stream of smoke. It was unseasonably cool, but she felt like a furnace had torched beneath her skin. A vice of dread tightened in her chest as the memories rushed in. Her house had been full of people for weeks after it happened, the local cops and then more from the state, pastors, neighbors, relatives, friends. It seemed like everyone they'd ever known was in and out of their home at some point. As a kid, her social anxiety had manifested as selective mutism, and the crowds filling their home were almost as terrifying as the disappearance of her sister. When she hadn't been able to escape to her room, she'd learned how to fade into the woodwork. But that didn't mean she didn't see and hear what was going on. She inhaled again, then considered the cigarette in her hand. At the time, her mom had said tragedy brought out the best in people, but Janie wasn't so sure. People had said the right things, but she'd sensed a furtive look of excitement in their eyes, layered under the sympathy. As if they were thrilled, and even a little bit scared to be on the fringe of the most horrible thing that could happen to a family. Like adrenaline-seeking kids sneaking up to the town's haunted house on a dare, slapping a hand on its siding and then racing back to safety just for the bragging rights. We were this close. A car door slammed, and her spine shot with tension. But Matt Thorson, another employee, several years older than Janie, just hurried through the parking lot toward the back door. He passed within a foot of her, but never even glanced at her as he entered the building. She relaxed again as the screen door slammed behind him. It was inevitable, she supposed, taking another puff, for any female in the state under 19 to elicit the media hysteria that always led back to the Willards' door. And probably to the killer's previous victims' families, too. Now that she thought about it. Worse still were the times when unidentified female human remains were discovered. The inevitable calls about testing the remains and comparing the results to Kelsey's DNA always had her mother in bed for days. The aftermath of Kelsey's kidnapping was a carousel of horrors they could never escape. She sank along the chilly siding to sit on the frigid cement sidewalk. A better person would be concerned about the unknown girl from Saxon Falls, And maybe Janie would have been, if she hadn't experienced this so many times. The idiot would show up eventually, after running away, joyriding with a friend, or shacking up with a boyfriend. They always did. But not before reporters started dredging up the past, leaving her mom an emotional basket case and her dad just a little more detached than before. It'd be easy to hate journalists for that alone. She brought the cigarette to her lips again. They'd been all too quick to forget the Willards when leads on Kelsey's case started drying up, when the police came by less and less frequently. That was about the time her mom and dad's friends, the ones who hadn't started avoiding them altogether, started wearing this totally fake, cheerful expression when they talked about anything and everything other than Janie's sister. Finally, the cops just stopped returning phone calls. More than a year went by, and still no Kelsey. Even at 11, Janie had realized what that meant. Kelsey wasn't coming back, no matter what her parents said. Her life was divided into a before and after two chapters in the same book. First, she had a sister. Then she didn't. She ground her cigarette out on the cement next to her, then lit another. You can't consider the meds a crutch and not realize cigarettes are serving the same purpose. Dr. Drake's words echoed in her brain. Sometimes what he said made sense, whether she wanted to hear it or not. But some things he just didn't have a clue about, like how she was always going to be defined by Kelsey's disappearance, and how that could ruin her memories of her sister if she let it. A mental image floated across her mind. She and Kelsey when they were kids, arms out to their sides, twirling in endless circles across the yard, pretending to be butterflies. Fly high, Janie. Fly high. Their mom had even bought them matching butterfly necklaces for Christmas that year. She smiled a little at the memory, abruptly sobered when she recalled that Kelsey had been wearing hers when she vanished. She exhaled, and like the stream of smoke, the memory dissipated, to be replaced with thoughts of the unknown teen from Saxon Falls. No matter that she was likely off on a lark, her disappearance was doing a number on those she left behind. It was hard to summon sympathy for a girl who intentionally churned emotional waters in her wake. She didn't know what Janie did, but tragedy changed a family. Sometimes it shattered it. Parents split up. The surviving kids developed coping mechanisms. She smiled grimly. Coping mechanisms. A $200-an-hour phase that meant searching for normal. God knew that was what she'd spent too many years doing before she was old enough to realize that normal was unattainable, because it didn't exist. At least not for the Willards. Not anymore. The chimney stack on the restaurant next door belched a thin thread of smoke, not unlike the one she expelled. Her sister's kidnapping hadn't destroyed them. Not totally. But it was as if someone had taken an eraser to her family, smudge, smudge, smudge. One fraction at a time, Kelsey had faded away until there was just the slightest shadow. And the rest of them were a bit fainter around the edges. Still there, but they were all a little less. She flicked the ash off the end of the cigarette into the graveled parking lot that hemmed the walk, watched the embers glow. Knew she'd have to keep a close eye on her mom for the next few days. Turn off the phone. Try to keep her away from the TV, lose the morning paper. Because it didn't take much these days to spin Claire Willard off her carefully constructed orbit. Janie knew just how fragile her mother was beneath her elegant, stylish exterior. Claire played bridge with friends twice a month, volunteered at church, and had her city clubs, the ultimate suburban housewife. If anyone else knew how much time she spent sitting on Kelsey's bed with a glass of vodka, they didn't talk about it. Not even Janie's dad. Especially not her dad. Janie's mouth tightened. Years ago, her parents used to have some pretty ugly fights about her mom's drinking, about his work, and God, why couldn't Claire just put the damn past behind her? But somewhere along the line, they must have called a truce. Sometimes Janie missed the fighting. At least that emotion had felt real. She watched the traffic on the road in front of the business without really seeing it. Life had a way of moving forward from even the worst circumstances. Eventually, everyone resumed their roles. Janie thought her parents deserved awards for theirs. They came to school conferences, they told her how proud they were of her grades. Getting up in front of the class for a speech could still turn her into a quivering case of nerves, but there was nothing wrong with her brain. Which was why, now that college acceptance letters had started rolling in, she finally had her ticket out. Until graduation, though, she was content enough with the part she played, the quiet loner everyone overlooked. Because most of the time, that suited her just fine.
Is Janie back here?
She scrambled to her feet as Doris's words traveled through the open back door. Dropping the cigarette, Janie stepped on the butt and leaned down for her purse.
Janie?
The manager stuck her head outside, swiveling it to either side. She opened her mouth to answer but then heard Matt's voice.
I just came in and I didn't see her.
Well, where in heaven's...
The door shut on the rest of the woman's words. A resigned laugh escaped her as Janie walked back to the entrance. If that wasn't the perfect summary of her existence for the last 7 years... Her sister was a ghost. But it was Janie who was invisible.
Claire Willard. November 2nd, 12 p.m. I know spring is months away, but it's never too soon to start planning. I'd love to see us do the county park beds in purple and red salvia. Petunias are so... I swear the boy got that lazy gene from his father. He doesn't even shower some days, and forget about asking him to lift a...
Quinn's 3-day sale. Don't you just love their shoes?
Claire Willard sipped from her vodka martini and let the snippets of luncheon conversation swirl around her. The second drink of the day always softened the edges a bit, made it worth the painstaking care she took with her appearance. By the third or fourth glass, the difficulty she'd had getting out of bed that morning would be long forgotten. She coveted the blessed numbness, guarded it closely, like the collection of rainbow-colored pills she kept secreted inside a tiny drawer at the base of an antique clock in her bedroom. Monday luncheon at the West Bend Country Club was a weekly mainstay, except around the holidays, when most people were frantically busy with preparations. The participants varied slightly from week to week, as the other women had appointments, prior commitments, or God knew what else to keep them busy. Sometimes Claire purposefully stayed away, to keep up the pretense that she, too, had a life so full that it was a struggle to fit it all in.
Claire, what do you think? You always have such lovely taste.
She blinked, and with an accuracy honed by long practice, refocused.
You know me. I'm all about the perennials. I'd love to see Central Park's beds in a blanket of tulips. Go with daylilies for the summer, and mums in the fall.
Then we only need to plant a tenth of the annuals, just as borders. More expensive in the short term, but it will save the organization money in the long run. The suggestion required little thought, as it was one that got bandied about yearly. At times, she wondered if these women really cared about the colors of the flower beds they tended for the city, the latest fashions, or minor family conflicts, or if, like her, they immersed themselves in trivialities in a frantic effort to avoid a yawning inner emptiness that sometimes threatened to swallow them whole. Occasionally, she found such minutiae soothing. Normal, even. But at other times, when she was having a particularly dark day, it made her want to shriek at these women for wasting their time on such silliness, when there were far more important things to think about. Like missing children. Kidnapped girls. Her Kelsey. One day at a time. That's what she'd heard endlessly at that worthless support group she and David had attended for a while. She'd taken it one day at a time for 2,592 days. They'd said it would get easier. They'd lied. You're so clever, Deirdre. She leaned back slightly as the 20-something waitress laid a white-on-white patterned china plate down in front of her. Artful bits of lettuce were adorned with baby tomatoes under a sprinkling of blue cheese that masqueraded as salad.
You always find the best sales. I swear I'm going to plant a GPS on your car and tail you whenever you go shopping. The women laughed, and Claire smiled serenely. Witticisms and pleasant chatter kept her a welcome member of the group. After Kelsey had been taken, she'd quickly learned that people had a finite tolerance for the suffering of others. Empathy went only so far before their personal comfort levels maxed out, and they started backing away from displays of grief. No one wanted to be reminded that tragedy befell without warning, striking at random. It was easier to believe that people bounced back from the most unimaginable heartbreak possible to once again care about five-inch heels and city beautification efforts. And that was possible only when others kept their pain to themselves. Claire had grown quite adept at keeping secrets. Once the salads had all been served, the clink of metal on china provided a melodious backdrop for the ebb and flow of conversations that entwined and detoured like garden paths. As usual, she was seated next to Barbara Hunt, who used to be her dearest friend, back when Claire had the energy to sustain such a relationship. She remained the closest thing to a friend Claire had, and if Barbara suspected there was far more going on than what Claire allowed to show on the surface, she had the grace not to pry and try to protect her from those who would.
Becca says Janie aced the chemistry exam last week, naturally.
Barbara looked up from her plate with a quick smile.
She's a bit jealous. Science comes so easily to Janie. I wish we could find a tutor with her knowledge next semester. The girl is barely scraping by with a C-.
Poor dear. The sympathy was automatic, but Claire's mind was elsewhere. Had Janie told her about the chemistry test? It was difficult to recall. But she thought not. David was the one who checked the school's online grades to keep tabs on Janie's academic progress. Claire focused on making sure her daughter went to her appointments with Dr. Drake and took the medication the man prescribed, a task she'd been failing miserably this school year. No one outside the family realized just how stubborn her socially reticent daughter could be. Maybe we could work a trade. And Becca could help Janie with English. She's having an awful time with Mr. Latham. Mostly because the man was an absolute sadist who was lax about accommodating for Janie's social anxiety disorder.
Oh, everyone has a terrible time in his class.
This from Mimi Swenson, a small, dark-haired woman who pecked at her salad like a finicky wren.
When I was in high school, he had me in tears weekly. I'm going to make sure Lisbeth doesn't have him when she's a senior. I hear he's turned into something of a lech.
Kelsey was a whiz in science, too, if I recall.
Claire stiffened slightly as Barbara continued to chatter.
Of course, she excelled at most things.
On some level, Claire realized what her friend was doing and was grateful for it. She was one of the few people who wasn't afraid to mention Kelsey's name. Most people acted as if she'd never existed, carefully avoiding a mention of her so as not to bring up unpleasantness. Barbara understood that it was like sharing a treat with someone starving. But the gratitude was filtered by pain. As always, it was the verb that stopped her. Kelsey was. Not Kelsey is. Not Kelsey will be. For the first few years, every time she'd heard her baby referred to in the past tense, it had been like a knife to the heart. And the first time she'd unthinkingly uttered it herself, Claire had cried for days. Because talking about Kelsey in the past tense meant that she'd finally given up hope, that she no longer believed that someday, somehow, her daughter would come home to them. Occasionally, she'd see a news story about a reunited family, and the mother would always say, "I never stopped believing. I always felt like I'd know if my child wasn't still out there." After 7 years, Claire hadn't given up hope either. But she hated that it was getting more and more difficult to summon.
"Yes," she said belatedly, her hand reaching for her glass again. "Both girls must have gotten their math and science acumen from their father. Heaven knows neither subject was my best."
"How fortunate that Janie shows an aptitude for science," Carla Farron chimed in. "In that field, she might be able to avoid public speaking altogether."
There was a nervous titter around the table at the comment, and Claire hid her quick burst of indignation behind a rueful smile. I know it's hard to believe, but she shows no qualms about debating household rules at great length. Maybe I should insist our discussions take place outside the school building. I might just win an argument once in a while. Laughter alleviated the tension. Carla was a relative newcomer to the group, having moved to West Bend to take a realtor's job a couple of years ago. Claire had never cared for her. She had a sly manner of faintly couching criticisms in humor. Just minutes earlier, she'd been complaining about her son's laziness, although from what Claire had heard, lack of ambition was the least of the boy's sins. He'd dropped out of school and had been in and out of trouble with the law. Is Josh looking at getting a GED, Carla? This from Barbara, as she pushed aside her salad plate with a sigh. I think he can do part of the work online these days, so it wouldn't interfere with his job. It was a well-orchestrated dance, Claire diffusing hurtful words with self-deprecating humor, and Barbara following up with a jab at the offender. Claire felt a sudden burst of affection for her friend. David often complained about the dog-eat-dog world of marketing, but these weekly luncheons required skilled verbal thrust and parry that was its own type of warfare. Two faint spots of color rode high on Carla's cheekbones. Yes, of course, we have a school psychologist looking into it. At least you know where he is, Susan Prescott put in from across the table. Isn't it horrible about that missing girl over in Saxton Falls? They still haven't found her, and it's been all over the news. Susan's words yanked Claire from humor to dread with whiplash speed, and for the first time that afternoon, all the snippets of conversation congealed into the same topic. It was Helen DeVries's granddaughter. My hairdresser does Helen's hair, and she's just distraught. Probably took up with some boy. She's been gone nearly 3 days already. I hear the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation was called in. The locals aren't wasting any time, especially after what happened to... Ow! That's my toe. I'm so sorry, Mimi. How clumsy of me. Barbara made a production of fussing over the other woman, seated on the other side of her. I had such a cramp in my foot, but I didn't mean to set it down on you. Are you all right? I swear I'm such a klutz sometimes. Why, just the other day. Claire became belatedly aware that her fork was suspended in midair, and had been since the topic had been introduced. Slowly, as if disconnected from her body, her hand lowered it to her plate, released it. Her chest constricted, making it an effort to breathe normally. It seemed as if news like this reared up to ambush her every few months. Something would appear in the papers or on TV that would cause the past to rage to the surface, every slice of pain and fear fresh again, hot and pulsing with new life. As if a stranger's tragedy belonged to her in some way, because she'd lived through it too. And this wasn't even a stranger. She knew Helen DeVries. Claire and the woman used to attend the same church. Whitney, the girl's name was. She'd be about the same age Kelsey had been when she was taken. I'm so sorry, Claire. Mimi looked shaken, whether from her verbal faux pas or her throbbing toe, it was difficult to tell. I'm sure the girl will be found safely.
Yes.
Because the word came out husky, Claire cleared her throat. But her poor parents. Barbara's hand snaked out to capture hers under the table, gave it a brief squeeze. Claire felt like a fraud, because her words had been automatic, a sound of empathy when, in fact, she possessed none. Dealing with the loss of Kelsey should have made her more attuned to the agony of others, but too often it felt like a contest of who had suffered more. Whitney is probably alive. She'll eventually return unhurt and happy, not gone forever, dead or as good as. The waitress began clearing the salad plates. Claire fought an overwhelming urge to excuse herself. David. She needed to call David. It was a habit she'd tried to break herself of because her husband had grown weary of it years ago. Each instance when she heard details of a missing child on the news, Every time she learned of some atrocity inflicted on a young girl, the details would take up residence in her brain and lodge there, like a burrowing parasite spreading its poison out until it was all-consuming. Certainty would grow that the case mirrored Kelsey's fate. She'd been murdered by her kidnapper, forced into child prostitution, the victim of a pedophile. There had been a time, a long time ago, when her husband had tried to calm her when she'd worked herself into a state over news like that, when they'd embraced tightly to form a human shield, a fragile defense against an unimaginably cruel fate. Those days were long past. Claire couldn't remember the last time David had touched her in any but the most casual of ways. And still, the familiar urge burned hotly within her, demanding a release. "Claire, your entree looks delicious. You have to tell me if it's as good as it looks, for the sake of my waistline. Please lie to me." At Barbara's words, she realized their lunches had been served. Like an automaton, she picked up her fork. The first bite was tasteless. So was the second. She was thinking of Whitney DeVries's parents. She always thought of the parents when she heard news like this. Not what they were feeling. Not sympathy for what they were going through. No. Claire always found herself wondering what they hadn't told the police.
David Willard, November 2nd, 2:54 p.m. "Great news on the Turnbull account, Willard." Steve Grayson stopped David in the hallway, flashing his toothpaste-ad smile. "You pulled that one out of the fire. Sometime over drinks you'll have to tell me how you kept them from following through on their threat to go with Samuel's marketing." The man stepped closer, lowered his voice. "I'm hearing murmurs of corporate espionage." "Espionage? That's water cooler gossip, Steve," David said easily. "Although I did discover some interdepartmental errors that almost cost us the client." His cell phone vibrated. Checking the screen, he saw that it was another call from Claire. He held the phone up. "I have to take this." With a wave, he headed toward his office, his corner office, and the symbol of everything he had that Steve Grayson wanted. There had been times in the last few days when he'd been certain that the man was finally going to get it. But yesterday, he'd finally prevented Turnbull from jumping ship, and today, his world was right again. David stopped by his assistant's desk and plucked a fistful of blue while-you-were-gone notes from her outstretched hand. "Mr. Shriver called and wants you in his office at 3:30. David checked his watch. He had half an hour. "Everything else there," Tracy gave a nod to the messages he'd taken from her, "can wait until tomorrow, except for Claire. She called twice. She sounded upset, David. She said you weren't answering your cell, but when I asked, she said it wasn't an emergency." "Really?" He frowned at the phone he still held, making a show of thumbing through his call log. "Nothing here. I swear, I'm getting another carrier. This one drops calls all the time. I'm sure that's what happened with hers." He shoved his cell back in his pocket and headed toward his inner office. David dropped the messages on his desk to deal with later and crossed to his private bathroom. Figuring he had time for a shave and to change his shirt, he unknotted his tie, already planning strategy. Kurt Shriver would have heard about the near debacle with the Turnbull account. Grayson would have made damn sure of that. Which underscored David's suspicion that the younger man was behind the screw-ups. Kurt would be livid, David figured, as he quickly shaved his 5 o'clock shadow and turned toward the closet. Taking a fresh white shirt from a hanger, he slipped it on. But Kurt would calm down after they discussed the interest Bonner Nursery was showing following a meeting David had had with them. Still plotting strategy, he re-entered his office, shoving his shirt tails into his zipped pants, and then started. "Jesus, Claire!" His wife rose from the edge of the couch she'd been perched on. "Did I startle you? Tracy showed me in. Why didn't you call me back?" "I just got into the office myself." He zipped up and grabbed his suit jacket from the chair he'd draped it over. Donning it, he added, "I had my cell turned off during my meetings today, so I missed your calls, but I'm afraid I've got to meet with Kurt in a few minutes. What do you need?" He stopped, a sudden stab of concern piercing his impatience. "Is Janie okay?" "Yes, of course," she made a face. still insisting on Stanford after she's already been offered a full ride at OSU, and quite vocal about it. She actually made a list of her reasons for attending a university halfway across the country. I swear, under different circumstances, she'd make an excellent trial lawyer. One conversation with her, and I feel like I've gone through 3 rounds in the ring. He felt a flash of relief. She's a teenager. She's supposed to be argumentative. That behavior, at least, was normal. A description that didn't always fit their youngest. Yes, but she's particularly good at it. They shared a rueful smile, and he looked, really looked at his wife for the first time in a while, he realized. She was impeccably dressed, still a damn fine-looking woman. But she could no longer completely hide the shadows beneath her eyes, and despite the subtle plastic surgery she'd had last year, there were stress lines that creased her mouth when she was worried, like she clearly was now. There's a girl missing, and David, she lives just a few miles away. Do you think... could it be... His gut nodded. Skirting her gaze, he strode to the briefcase he'd laid on his desk and opened it, re-examining the contents to make sure he'd have everything he needed for the upcoming meeting. Claire, his voice was as soft as he could manage. Don't do this. I know the girl's grandmother. We both attended Trinity Baptist in Saxon Falls. How can that happen here again? You don't think Kelsey's kidnapper... that he's back? The last two words had his shoulders slumping. God, he was tired of this. Tired of being the strong one. Tired of replaying this scene every damn time some girl forgot to tell her parents where she was going for a few hours. No, I don't. Snapping the briefcase shut, he turned to face her. But what if it is? His wife's voice was getting that strident tone he recognized, and damn it, he didn't have time for a scene. Claire! His tone was sharper than he meant it to be. This has nothing to do with Kelsey. Every bad thing that happens to a child in this country isn't connected to her. He had to draw a breath, difficult to do when his chest felt hollowed out. It was 7 years ago. You have to get some... distance. God knew it was the only thing that had kept him sane. He'd spent months after his daughter's disappearance on the edge of a yawning, black and roiling precipice before he'd made a conscious decision to move away from it. With every passing year, he took another step back. Claire remained teetering on the brink, arms wheeling. One wrong move would have her free-falling into that darkness. He'd given up thinking he could save her from it. Some days he thought she wanted to leap into the abyss. Because he wasn't willing to provide that push, he crossed to her, and she flung herself at him. His arms, stiff and wooden, were slow to slip around her. Helplessness rose up inside him as he felt the shudder shake her frame. Every time he touched her, he was reminded of his failures. A better man would have found a way to help her heal from the trauma of losing their daughter. Instead, somehow he'd managed to lose both his daughter and his wife. He was a louse of a husband, and not much better than a part-time father to Janie. But those weren't the character flaws that kept him awake at night. It was the spectacular way he'd failed Kelsey 7 years earlier.
Special Agent Mark Foster. November 2nd, 4:02 p.m. Sleet pinged off the window behind Mark as he shifted awkwardly in front of the interview room. As miserable as the weather had become outside, given the chance he'd switch locations in a heartbeat. The crowd of journalists danced and bobbed before him as the reporters jockeyed for position.
We're here at the request of Saxon Falls Chief of Police Don Masterson to assist in the investigation in any way we can.
The booming voice of Ben Craw, senior agent with the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, required no amplification to carry across the conference room inside the police headquarters.
Our first concern is to see that Whitney DeVries returns home safely.
Is this in any way tied to Halloween? Will there be an Amber Alert?
Does she have a history as a runaway?
Did the girl have a boyfriend?
Mark stood stoically at Craw's side, grateful he wasn't the one having to answer the questions lobbed at them like live verbal grenades. He did his best work in the field, Thrusting a microphone in his face was an open invitation for him to say something stupid, one he usually obliged. Craw was an old hand at this. He'd been with the state's top investigative agency for nearly 30 years. Every day of it showed on his face.
We have no evidence to suggest foul play at this time.
Craw raised his hands to halt the frenzy of voices before continuing.
All signs point to the girl leaving her home willingly. At 7:45 Saturday morning, Mrs. DeVries woke up after tending to her ill son all night. She went to her daughter's room to check on her. The inside screen on the girl's bedroom window had been removed and the window was open. She immediately woke her husband, a deputy with the local sheriff's office, who commenced searching for her. Mrs. DeVries stayed home with her son, who was still sick.
The reporters had quieted, all furiously scribbling. Mark figured they realized that further interruptions at this point were useless.
Deputy DeVries alerted the police and spent the next few hours contacting several of Whitney's friends from school, none of whom admitted knowledge to her whereabouts.
Craw continued. He was consulting no notes. The man's memory for detail was uncanny.
At 2 o'clock p.m., a canine unit was brought in from Cleveland. The dog followed the girl sent to the Saxon Falls City Park, where it ended. That indicates to us that she may have gotten into a vehicle with someone, and that's a lead we're actively investigating.
Mark caught a glimpse of Shannon and Brian DeVries at the back of the crowd and mentally cursed. He'd specifically advised the parents against attending the press conference, as their presence was guaranteed to turn the event into a media free-for-all. He caught Chief Masterson's eye across the dais, and the man's brow furrowed. He'd seen them too. All they could do now was brace themselves for the fallout. Craw was going to be pissed. But even given his irritation with the couple, he couldn't altogether blame them. His son, Nicky, was 3, and Mark could only imagine how he'd feel if the boy disappeared. It was bad enough that his wife kept extending her and Nicky's visit with her parents in Bowling Green. A 1-week stay had already stretched into 2. He missed the kid like crazy. If they caught a quick break in this case, he'd take a couple of days' leave and drive over there to see him. Imperceptibly, he shifted his weight. And while he was at it, he'd deal with his wife, Kelly. He had no idea what was going on in her head. He damn well hoped this stay was still just a visit. Getting a straight answer from her was getting increasingly difficult. For the last several months, their conversations had had a habit of degenerating into accusations and tears. Family life was never smooth sailing. His attention wandered back to the DeVrieses. Mark knew from personal experience that in every marriage there was always something going on beneath the surface, which was why he and Craw were going to have to take a closer look at the DeVries family dynamics.
Anyone with knowledge of Whitney's whereabouts, or who may have seen or heard from her recently, is encouraged to call this number.
Craw indicated a large card Masterson held up, bearing a toll-free number in bold block print.
That's all we have for you today.
There was an instant tumult. No one believed the press would be dismissed that easily, but as planned earlier, Craw handed off the microphone to Masterson, who would do his best to respond to questions without revealing any more details. Mark didn't envy the man his task, but he and the other agent were already heading out of the room. Other than a shouted question or two tossed their way, most of the attention remained on the chief.
You're about 30 seconds from being the center of a media circus,
Mark murmured to Brian DeVries when he reached his side. Craw flanked Mark, shielding their exchange from the reporters in the room. If the older agent was the master of the press, Mark's fort was dealing with the distressed parents.
If that's what you want, we can't prevent it. But open that door, and they'll never give you a moment's peace.
DeVries jutted his jaw.
We have a right to be here.
He was a slight man, maybe 5'6", with a vaguely antagonistic attitude. As a law enforcement officer, he should know enough to cooperate with the investigation, but instead he seemed to think he knew best how to handle it. It was going to be a test of Mark's patience to maintain a civil relationship with him.
You do, he gave a nod. It's your choice. But if it's one you're going to make, you'll make it alone. We're not going to run interference for you.
Shannon DeVries's dark eyes were worried as she looked to her husband for reassurance.
Maybe we should leave. I don't want them following us home.
What if they try to talk to Ryan? Mark could have told her that the longer her daughter remained missing, the more likely it was that she would have unwanted company camped in front of her home, but that was a conversation for later. If the weather didn't improve, they might get a reprieve for the time being, regardless.
I don't need anyone running interference.
But Brian DeVries scanned the crowd of reporters again and looked uncertain.
We just wanted to hear if you had any details to release.
Inching toward the door, Mark imperceptibly herded the two along with him.
When we do, you'll hear about it before the press does.
Craw reached for the knob, and Mark felt a spark of relief when the couple slipped through it ahead of him. Outside the conference room, he motioned to a young police officer.
Show Mr. and Mrs. DeVries the back exit and follow them home. Make sure they don't get hassled.
The man nodded, and after a short pause, the couple turned to follow him.
Now why can't you be that smooth in front of a microphone?
Ben Cross searched inside his suit jacket pockets for some gum. He fought a continually losing battle against smoking. He quit at least a dozen times in the last year. Mark kept track. Craw found a piece and unwrapped it, popping it into his mouth as he scanned the open space outside the room.
Then what would you do?
Put out fires before they start.
He jerked a thumb at the door they'd just exited.
Did you hear the question shouted out there at the end by the loudmouth from KKXT?
At Mark's headshake, he continued.
Wanted to know if this was the work of the 10-mile killer. Christ on a cracker.
He shook his head in disgust.
We've got no forced entry. Evidence that the girl left the house of her own accord, and some bozo already has her the victim of a serial killer.
One who's probably died of old age by now. It was the wrong thing to say. Craw's blue eyes narrowed, and he jabbed a finger at Mark's chest.
There's no evidence linking this girl to the TMK. That case over in West End deep sixed Tom Hannity's career. He's a damn fine agent and a good friend of mine. It's always easy to second guess that the guy did everything right near as I could tell, but couldn't catch a break in the investigation. And because of it, every runaway, every Amber Alert, every kid who gets lost in the tri-state area has the press dragging that case out again. Anything for a story, right? But mark my words, when the DeVrieses hear it brought up, and they will, they're gonna make your life a living hell.
He started off toward Masterson's office. Mark followed more slowly.
Me? Why me? Because you're good with parents, remember? I'm the guy who handles the media.
Whitney DeVries, November 2nd, 5:32 p.m. He was back. She could hear him breathing. Whitney guiltily scrambled off the blow-up mattress, the chain attached to the manacle on her wrist jangling. Her prison was a large, shadowy room with a raised stage at one end, where she was shackled to a long bar attached to the back wall. The place was nearly dark. The only light came from a computer screen and a projector, centered somewhere in the middle of the room, and the flickering, illuminated scene it cast on the white cement block wall behind her.
Whitney, dear.
She hugged her arms around her middle, feeling chilly and exposed in the thin leotard. His voice made her feel that way, like a fingernail lightly running down her spine. Quickly, she made her way to the center of the stage.
What are rules 1 and 7?
Her mind went blank, like it did whenever Mrs. Zahner called on her in math, because Whitney and a friend were whispering. But this time she knew the answer. She did, but there were so very many rules. Not to, she stuttered, buying time. And then her mind cleared, and a spasm of relief shook her. Not to stop practicing before the film is over.
Very good. And rule number 1?
The voice was deep and slow, and sort of hollow-sounding. Maybe it seemed freakier because it always came from the dark. No matter how hard she peered, she could never make out more than a shadow. Or maybe it was because it never changed. Happy? Angry? Who knew with the freak? It was always even. I may use the bed from 9 p.m. to 7:15 a.m.
Well, now I'm confused. It's only 5:30. You do seem to know the rules. You just didn't obey them.
The flesh on her arms rose. She began to shake.
I want to be fair, Whitney. I really do. If you have a logical reason for your disobedience, now's your chance to tell me.
How could crazy sound so normal? He could have been her dad.